Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a woke, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's October the 9th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, you may remember that last week I mentioned that I really don't like doing secret squirrel stuff on this podcast, by which I mean using it to communicate with people who are so raving paranoid that they refuse to give me a working return address, either by email or regular post. I don't like it because, numero uno, I think I may have been successfully trolled by the Chicago guy's stalker like that, although I know who he is now. And secondly, because I've explained on several prior occasions, if you've ever made so much as a slightly politically incorrect remark or told a slightly politically incorrect joke online, it has been archived by the NSA. It's sitting in one of those huge databases they maintain in Utah or West Virginia. And if they haven't had time to get around to you and catalog your various subversions and ideological deviations yet, they will. Like the Viking said to the Arab in the 13th Warrior, go and hide in a hole if you wish. You won't live 1 minute longer. Your fate is fixed. Fear profits man nothing. That having been said, I'm going to start off this week with some secret squirrel. Yeah, I know. To quote Sir Mick Jagger, you can't always get what you want. First off, to the anonymous individual who is the last among you to be burning CDs of Radio Free Northwest on his computer and sending me a few each week, like I asked you guys to do over a year ago. Yes, you have the correct Port Orchard address now. Thank you very much for keeping it up so long after the others lost interest and wandered away. Also, I received your letter as well as the enclosure. Your efforts are deeply appreciated, and I hope you'll keep it up. Secondly, to the comrade in Santa Ana, California, who contacted me. Yes, I have received your letter. I would like to hear from you further. Please give me a name and address, either email or postal mail. Again, I say they almost certainly already know who you are despite your best efforts. And in any case, you'll find that standing erect like a man again instead of crouching and hiding like a whipped dog is a sufficiently wonderful rush to make it worth the risk. Thirdly, to the new comrade who is making his scouting trip to Idaho in a couple of days, it would really help if I knew exactly where you are looking at as a possible residence. Idaho's a big place. Yes, we have some people there, but I need more details. We're coming up short in Idaho and Oregon for official greeters. Understandably so, in Oregon especially, our people are especially impoverished, and they can't risk job loss, but that doesn't help the situation. We really need someone in both states who's willing to set up a formal unit complying with the standards laid down in the 5th edition White Book. Guys, I'm not kidding. This kind of thing is not what this podcast is for, and I don't want to start a trend of people playing internet games hoping that they can get a mention on here by playing silly buggers and not providing me with their own contact info. I know that some of you who do this are genuinely and legitimately afraid for your jobs, especially since more and more the NF is attracting people who actually have something to lose through what the lefty libs call economic discipline. But nothing is ever going to happen so long as white men are so afraid of their own shadows. Now remember, you can't hide from your enemies. You can only successfully hide from your friends. And while I'm on the subject, can we come up with a somewhat better, more accurate, and descriptive term for the non-Jewish established power structure than the left, or the liberals, or progressives, or whatever? All of their own terms for themselves are too mild and innocuous, not to mention inaccurate. I'd call them the Reds, like we used to do in the old days, but we now have this whole red state, blue state thing that's messing up that imagery and confusing everybody. I like Bill White's recently invented terminology. I just call it the dictatorship, and the FBI and the courts and whatnot are the dictator's servants. Now, some of you may have noticed that I'm using that term recently, and just to make it clear, that was Bill's idea, although he doesn't do it often. He used it in one or two of his letters, and I just picked up on it. Just so you know that I'm not claiming that I originated it, just like J.K. Rowling actually invented the term muggles, i.e., non-magical people, which I use to refer to dumbass white boys and bimbos who don't know who they are. Moving right along here, last week I was talking about how one of the big advantages of having me as a full-time, more or less paid employee, if an erratically paid one, is so that the party will have a figurehead available who is financially bulletproof and who can step forward and do media interviews with no hostages to fortune so the dictatorship can't retaliate against my family members. And no job, so I'm not vulnerable to what the power structure calls economic discipline. Well, by sheer coincidence or synchronicity or whatever, a few days later I was contacted by a woman named Ashley Minnelli, who works for Carolina Fox News, which is the Fox subnetwork for upstate South Carolina based in Greenville, but also with a big viewership up in Charlotte, around my old stomping grounds in North Carolina. I'll play that clip for you in a minute, but first let me point out that this is a pretty typical soundbite of the littering variety, and for those of you who came in late, I need to explain what littering is. Littering, in the white nationalist context, is a propaganda technique which virtually every one of our grouplets has used on occasion, but which was developed into a kind of art form by the National Alliance back in the 1990s. It's actually fairly simple and cost-effective, and all it takes is a slight amount of testicular follication on the part of one or more people. This is how it works. An individual or a small group of people get hold of some leaflets from whatever passes for the grouplet's so-called national headquarters. Or else they create some kind of leaflet or flyer on their own, and they photocopy these at their local Kinko's, usually no more than a couple of hundred of them, if that. Sometimes it's just business cards, or in this case, a single business card, and that got us almost 3 minutes of regional network airtime, so it's what Andy would call a very high ROI. These leaflets and business cards are then mysteriously distributed by night, in person, by hand, which is what makes it so scary for the local lefty libs and niggas and authorities. It's real world. It's not internet.
Yeah! They was here! They was right here, Mabel! Wicked and evil white supremacists right in our goddamn driveway spreading all that hate and all them Nazi cooties! We got Nazi cooties on our lawn now, Mabel!
Now, the leaflets are sometimes rolled up in plastic bags to keep out the rain and actually placed on doorsteps or hung on doorknobs like Chinese takeout menus. But more often, they're simply thrown onto porches or dropped in driveway in the dead of night by people who then scamper off. Very seldom more than a few hundred of them, more often only 50 or 60. And usually that's enough. Hence the term littering, because usually that's literally what it is, although there is a reason for that. Now, this one business card in Greenville was either mailed or placed in a mailbox. The video isn't clear on that. But one thing all of you need to internalize, it is a federal felony to put anything in a mailbox without a stamp on it, so don't do that. The FBI will use that as a handle to try and identify anyone in a given area whose minds are not under control. And yes, they will send a whole special task force to a given area with fingerprint and DNA kits to try and identify people who have been putting leaflets in mailboxes without a 49-cent stamp on them. Now, they've done it before. Remember back about 8 years ago at the time of the Jana 6 case in Louisiana, when the FBI was sending out task forces to try and identify who was hanging children's toys on pieces of twine in schools and fire stations? Now, they don't give a damn about the so-called federal offenses themselves. What they want is to find out who you are and add you to their databases. Got to have that data. They know that knowledge is power, and they have convinced themselves that if they can just somehow know everything there is to know about everybody in America and figure out some way to watch everybody all the time, then they can stave off their own day of reckoning. Now, they can't, but they're too dumb to get that. Anyway, when a neighborhood is hit with a littering raid, the way it always goes is when some hysterical white calls the police. Now, you would be amazed at how many white people really do believe that to read or be in possession of a piece of racial literature of any kind is an actual criminal offense. And a lot of whites will actually call the police and demand that they come and take the literature away, like it was a bomb or something. Which I suppose in a way it is. A bomb that can blow up a whole tower of delusion and level an empire. Now, the police report the call on their blotter and the local media catches on to the story. Then there is a set pattern, almost symbiotic, between the racist group and the Southern Poverty Law Center. First, there's a couple of paragraphs, or maybe the first 15 seconds or so, if it's a television spot, and that describes the leaflet or the business card with a brief quote or a brief visual on camera. Then comes a quote or two from fearless leader of the group or some other spokesman, whoever they can find. And then comes the de rigueur quote from Mark Potok. Although, in our case, during the time of the Fort Carson incident, they picked some Jew running some liberal think tank in California. Anyway, I'll let you hear it.
Big story at 11 o'clock. A business card from a white separatist group based in Seattle, Washington, was delivered to a Greenville County man's mailbox. And the message they're sending isn't sitting well with him. The card came from Northwest Front. On their website, the group says its goal is to create an independent white nation in the Pacific Northwest.
Fox Carolina's Ashley Minnelli has been looking into the group, and she joins us live in our newsroom with both sides of this story. Ashley?
Well, Diana, Cody, the man I spoke with tells me he's disturbed by Northwest Front's line of thinking, and he tells me there is no place for it here in the upstate.
Whether it was meant for him or not, this message that came addressed to him in the mail.
If white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening.
Has left this Greenville County man, who didn't want to give his name, wishing he could send it back. He says this card was in an envelope without a return address.
It's borderline disturbing knowing that people are out there like that.
The people he's referring to are those who follow something called Northwest Front.
The central part of our message is that white people are a group under threat. We are facing the genocide of our race.
Spokesperson for the group, Harold Covington, says he's a white separatist who wants all white people to migrate to the Northwest to create a white nation.
Our main message to people in South Carolina and anywhere else our message spreads is that they need to come here.
The Southern Poverty Law Center has spent the last 30 years tracking hate groups. While Northwest Front claims there's no hate behind its ideas, SPLC names it as one of 10 hate groups in Washington state, but says people in the upstate should put its presence in perspective.
I know it is not pleasant to receive this kind of literature. The idea that this group is somehow going to be arriving locally in large numbers, I think it's very unlikely.
As for the man who received this card, he wants people to know the ideas behind it don't belong in this area.
Stay out of the upstate. Everybody I know down here, we're all a bunch of loving people. We don't need to fool around with them.
And Covington did say he is not surprised someone in the same lining thinking as his group is spreading literature here in the upstate. Now, the Greenville County man I spoke with says he still has no idea how he got the card. And he did tell me he has spoken with neighbors who say they have not received any literature. Diana, Cody?
So, Ashley, as for the Northwest Front, does it seem like they're planning to do anything other than mailing out cards like that one in our area?
Well, one thing Covington did make clear to me tonight is that this is more of an idea or a concept. It's not necessarily an organization that moves in masses. So, Diana, the answer to your question, no. We are likely not going to see a rally of that kind here in the upstate anytime soon. Reporting live in the newsroom tonight, Ashley Minnelli, Fox Carolina News Tonight.
Now, we were lucky in that the brief glimpse of the card during the first 15 seconds actually showed enough of the website so that anyone who's fairly quick on the uptake or who was TiVoing the show could catch it. And yes, we did receive a bump in website hits from the upstate South Carolina and Charlotte area, and it's generated a few inquiries thus far. And for the record, no, I have no idea who gave this guy the card or why. The card itself looked homemade. It had our own mantra on it, as you heard. All of this from one piece of Northwest Front literature strategically placed, an act carried out by a lone individual using a homemade business card. What do you think we could accomplish if we had 1,000 of you out there doing this every week?
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. Today, I'm wrapping up my Real Politics talks. I'm struggling with exactly how to frame the idea I want to convey, since getting my point across would actually require getting into your mind long enough to cause you to take a critical eye to the way you see yourself from a political standpoint. My reason for doing so is to try to convince some of you that, regardless of your intent, you've taken the stance that you are an inactive observer to the creation of the Northwest American Republic. This needs to change. But how should I go about this? Well, I can't find a general way of making my case without examples, so I may just have to start with a few cases and then point out the commonalities. Before I get going, though, I want to call out a couple of items I covered in my prior Real Politics talks. Way, way back in Real Politics 2, I covered human nature, and part of that subject is the sad reality that most of us are willing to wait for other people to do things for us. This can happen for various reasons, but today, my main concern is the expectation that we as individuals don't need to do anything. The other item I want to remind you of is my talk in the recent past on obsession and what it can do to someone's psyche. Keep those things in mind while I toss some ideas out. I'll start off easy and use a very well-known escape mechanism, which is religious in nature. While not specific to any religion in particular, it's most common in various types of Christianity. For the record, I've seen pagans do the same thing, so don't think I'm coming down for or against anyone's religion here. I'm critiquing behavior only. Anyway, we're all familiar with the "we're in the last days" routine. This phenomenon repeats itself about once every 10 years, and in some circles, every 2 or 3 years. People are so willing to put their lives on hold or to stop worrying about their own needs because they've managed to convince themselves the world is about to end. It rarely goes to extremes, but the effects are bad enough regardless. After all, if there aren't going to be any more days, or whatever, a person isn't too inclined to set any long-term objectives. But what else can cause this? In the last month, I have had the opportunity to communicate with quite a few people about race and the Northwest Front. And out of all of these communications, only a handful of them didn't reference economic or societal collapse. And to be fair, that's totally all right. Mostly. After all, quite a few of us, myself included, come to some sort of racial realization after coming to grips with various economic issues. We're all affected by the economy every day. Not noticing it would be impossible. I get it. But here's where obsession with the economy goes off the rails. It starts with excessive concern about when the balloon is going to go up. That's been the central concern of the American right for the last 60 years. It hasn't gotten us anywhere, and this alone should be reason enough to simply ignore it as a subject of discussion. So here we are. Now, I have to take a certain amount of responsibility for this problem, on behalf of the party, since we keep using the term, when the balloon goes up. That said, when we say it, we're talking about an event that actually causes white people to want to free themselves, not an economic happening. It's possible we've inadvertently caused some of you to get the wrong idea. Other times, we've made the situation even worse by using the same phrase to refer to some sort of governmental failure, which might give the party a golden opportunity to accomplish its objective. For those of you who know I'm responding in some way to something you've said to me in the recent past, don't think I'm trying to shoot you down, since, by association, I'm part of the problem. Perhaps the best example of what I'm getting at is a discussion I had in the last week on Facebook among one guy living in Idaho and some of his friends. The Idaho guy was talking up his friends about how an independent white nation might come about, and he offered two possibilities. Either there's a total economic and societal collapse, or else we all just form our own breakaway society and hope for the best. Anyone listening to Radio Free Northwest knows we've got an entirely different solution which actually allows us to be proactive about solving the problem. Here's the rub. In order to be proactive, you first have to see yourself as an active part of the situation rather than a neutral observer. That might seem obvious, but in practice, quite a few of you seem to have trouble with this. Granted, everyone I spoke with in the last month or so was quite well-meaning, and most of them expressed some level of concern for coming home to the Pacific Northwest like they're supposed to. On the other hand, the vast majority of references to the excrement hitting the fan, the breakup, the collapse, or whatever you want to call it, were troubling to me. Just about every time the subject came up, I got the impression, when it wasn't outright offered, that the people I'm talking to are putting off their homecomings to see if the collapse is going to happen first. There are two things wrong with this. Firstly, like the rapture or the end times or whatever, there's nothing concrete or set to wait on. That being the case, you're probably going to wait for a while. Someone has insisted it's the end of days ever since Christianity was founded, and to date, that hasn't panned out. For the last several decades, we on the right have predicted imminent economic collapse, and so far, none of us has been right either. Yeah, I get it. It sure seems like people are getting more evil as time passes. And we all know the Jew-run economy is dishonest and unmaintainable. But neither of these obsessions has ever produced anything helpful. So it's far past time to drop both of them and get on with the business of the Butler Plan. The second thing wrong with trying to anticipate the collapse is that you're subjugating yourself to outside events. Major life events always have some element of the unknown, but that doesn't stop us from attempting to control ourselves despite setbacks. Why is it that Northwest migration seems to be the exception everyone wants to draw to their normal behavior and effort? It's practically fringe, if you remember that particular real politics talk. Further, worry about the economy is fine if you're some sort of conservative. We're not. We're racists. We see past superficial problems to the underlying causes. Some of us even play at attempting to resolve those problems. If your eye is on the economy first and foremost, it can't be on race. Therefore, it can't be on the solution to the race problem. About half of the conversations which sparked the details I've used to make this point did include promises of expected homecoming. But even in these cases, there were suggestions of things for the party to do relating to the collapse. Okay, fine. But let's revisit those suggestions after you all come home, comrades. Obsession with the collapse is a good example of what happens when someone isn't paying attention to what really matters. For the sake of our race, can we all make an effort to set the bar a little higher for ourselves? Hail victory, comrades.
This is Steve Earle.
By one, the witnesses came, and they told him what it was. single one see the man who actually fired the gun. It was down in London, they were tried, and a guilty man stood free outside. When he took the stand to pay his debt, the judge was blind and the jury was dead. In Kingston town, they're locked up still. When the sun goes down and the air is chill, you can swear you heard Jim Donnelly's ghost cry, Johnston, Ontario.
Coming at you again. Yeah, something I forgot to mention on my last little segment on moving. U-Haul informed me the last time I rented a U-Haul when my truck broke down back in June that U-Haul is not used for commercial purposes, so you don't need to worry about stopping at the scales with a U-Haul truck, unlike Ryder and Penske and the rest of them that lease them out for commercial use and stuff, and they have to, I guess some of those have to stop at the scales. So U-Haul's not, so that might be something else for you to consider. And also, part of the segment for our comrade did about a week or so ago about from across the pond and his migration and stuff, just remember, you don't need passports, you don't need papers, or any of that to drive across country. Hey, we don't have border checkpoints, at least not yet. Lord only knows what Obungo's going to do. But at least at the moment, we don't have his Stalinist checkpoints out there to worry about. So you're free to drive across the country as needed without having to worry about paperwork checks. And unless you're doing a little bit of low altitude flying when you shouldn't be. I see a lot of that out here on the road. Anyway, so yeah, I apologize for not getting podcasts out, any segments out while I was home. I was busy stretching chain link fence and getting all that, the last hard chain link fenced up. So now I'm kind of relaxing back at work while I'm out on the road, not having to go and work out there in the heat and the sun and all that without the air conditioned truck. At least I'm not stretching fence anymore. But so hope to see your license plates headed towards the homeland. It's, like I said in the last segment, the weather is still decent, so you may as well make your trip before the snow starts to fly. All right, comrades, have a safe one, and we'll catch you later. This is a trucker signing off.
Trucker coming at you from the homeland. Didn't see but one U-Haul pass me on my way across Montana this last trip, coming back here. And wanted to go and talk to you a little bit about your prospective move and why you haven't moved yet. Touching on the electrical power system and stuff out here compared to where you're at. I was just online checking power rates and stuff, and out here in the Northwest, it's Washington State to be exact, our price per kilowatt hour is just under 9 cents an hour. And get over there, like into the New England states, you're talking just shy of 20 cents an hour. And just shy of 71% of our power is produced by hydroelectric. And natural gas is coming in at like 10% and on down from there. So yeah, the cost of living is a little bit less out here. You might want to think about that also. We have very little in the way of nuclear power plants out here. I think we have one or two. I can't remember exactly where they're at, but unlike up there in the Northeast and along the Great Lakes and stuff, where they have a lot of nuclear up there and also a lot of coal, our coal is down probably in less than 10% power production is from coal and stuff out here. When I'm trucking back and forth across Montana, I do see quite a bit of coal trains coming out here, but I'm not sure if they're coming to the Washington coal-fired plants or the Oregon ones, but I see them coming across the Burlington Northern tracks up here. Just waiting to see more of those license plates headed this way. We'll catch you later, comrades. Have a good one, and I thought you'd go on. Just kind of three tidbits out there to consider and stuff on that. Have a safe one, comrades, and hope to see you in the homeland soon.
Well, I'm down, 18-wheeler rolling. We're gonna do what they say can be done. We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old bandit run.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be reviewing Douglas Hyde's book, and this is one entitled Dedication and Leadership. Now, Douglas Hyde spent many years of his life as a communist, and later on he converted to Catholicism. And he's writing this book back in the 1960s, and he's trying to answer the question, why are the communists such a strong force at that time? Now, granted, he's writing this in the 60s, and therefore the book is somewhat dated. However, even though we don't really talk so much about communists today, and we don't have communists per se, we do have the left, or what I'll call the left for convenience sake. I think in a lot of ways, there is a certain similarity to the communists, and I also think these methods are very good and could be used by anyone. So that's why I've decided to review this book. The communists really like to bend to the idealism of youth, but even so, most of the people that joined really joined because they had met a communist that they admire. The reason that this often happened was that the communists asked a lot of their members, and one of the things that the communists stressed, they stressed education and discussion, and they were always having these new educational campaigns. So if the Communist Party decided on some new policy, this was always something that communist members would be able to discuss in classes or tutorial sessions or guided discussion groups. so that each member would come to understand policy changes. And the members are kept busy with all these classes and reading lists and new campaigns. And when somebody joins the Communist Party, first of all, they're asked to make a gesture of moral courage, where in this case, often they would distribute a newspaper on the sidewalk. And then people would ask them questions. If they didn't know the answers, they would have to go to these education classes. And all the members are told that they're part of a global struggle. And the Communist Party was very clever in that they had long-term goals, such as worldwide communism, but they also had intermediate goals, such as communism within the nation, and then shorter-term goals, such as improving the community. So they'd often go out and ask various peasants what they wanted, and then they would do something to improve community life, such as road building. And they would encourage all members to become leaders if at all possible. The author gives us the story of Jim, who was an unattractive man who had a very noticeable speech impediment, and how even this individual, the most unlikely of leaders, became very prominent in his trade union because of the way that the communists encouraged everyone to become a leader. So they encouraged you to be heavily involved in the party. However, you were also supposed to excel at your profession, because, again, if you didn't, then there was the concern that you might not have credibility among your peers. And using these techniques, communists often ended up recruiting the best of the best. And I really believe that anyone could use these techniques. The communists kept their ideas simple so that anyone could understand them. They kept track of various comrades to understand how a comrade could be best used by the party. And they're blunt about their mistakes. And they try to learn from them as best they can and then move forward. And with all of this work, at the end of the day, the comrades end up coming to this realization that nothing is too good for the party. And often, comrades will end up wishing for martyrdom of some kind. So clearly, zeal and dedication are commonplace. Now, yes, sometimes people come to the movement with a somewhat skewed notion of what the movement is all about, but through these educational classes, eventually their thought process will be corrected, and they come to the belief or the strong feeling that they have come to these ideas very much on their own because, again, there is so much discussion. And many communists, really, because they were so dedicated, they gave generously to the party. And that's something that Harold was talking about recently. He was talking about giving, and what you have to understand about giving is that it's a wager of faith. Let's say you did give the $10 a month, which is really very little, but let's say you gave it and there was no result to that giving. Well, okay, you've given a little, but it's not so much that you can't afford it. On the other hand, if you give and there is a result, then you've gotten an excellent return on your investment. Now, to think of it another way, if you have any bad habits, such as smoking or drinking, then better to quit or cut back on these bad habits and save a little money and give it to Harold, then continue with these bad habits. So that's another thing that you can think about in terms of giving. And I hope that we are able to have the organization in some way. And, you know, $10 a month, it's really not much. Even if you have nothing, generally you can give $10 a month. And if you really can't give $10 a month, then you really can't afford to even have an internet connection, so you really shouldn't even be listening to this. Now, as far as the $100 twice a year, that is rather a lot. And if you really can't afford that, then my advice would be that every month you give at least $10. But if one month you have a little bit more, you could give $20 one month. And then maybe the next month it could be $35. And the month after that it could just be maybe go back to just $10. And that way, you're giving extra, but you don't have to worry about a lump sum. You can give a little extra now and then. Maybe at Christmas time, you feel really generous, and you want to give $60 at Christmas, for example, or $40 at Thanksgiving. But maybe, generally speaking, it's $10 or it's $11. And then eventually, yes, there'll be probably that extra $100 over time. So that's how I would suggest that you handle that. I hope you enjoyed this review because even though we don't really have communism anymore, I think this would be a great way of influencing people, helping them to come to certain correct views. So I found this an exciting book, and it's available on Amazon for a very low cost, even just a few cents in some cases. So thank you for listening, and have a good evening, and hail victory.
This is a coal mining song, and the group is called the Whistle Pigs. Okay, I haven't answered any emails for a few weeks, so let's see what we've got piling up here. I'll try and get through as many of these as possible. First off, after Lord Lucan's segment last week, I got a couple of emails asking questions regarding what is known very vaguely among white nationalists as national Bolshevism, i.e. people who not only hate niggers and Jews, but who also hate rich people and capitalist employers as well, and have a tendency to mimic the rhetoric of the present-day lefty libs, like Occupy Wall Street, etc. Damn, we really do need a better name for these people, other than lefty libs. I mean, most of us just say the Jews, but the fact is that many of them aren't Jewish. They're white traitors who have made the deliberate decision to join our racial enemies in participating in genocide against their own people, which is something most of us don't want to face up to, so we really, really need to find some nomenclature that is both accurate and appropriately loathsome. Anyway, back to what I was talking about. In National Socialist circles, this quasi-communist tendency I refer to is known as Strasserism, after Gregor and Otto Strasser from the NSDAP period, and you guys can go Google them, I suppose, if you want more details. Long and very complicated story made as short as possible. In those days of the Kampfzeit in Germany, they had a lot of what were called beefsteak Nazis, brown on the outside and red on the inside. Now, this probably had a lot to do with the party deliberately recruiting ex-communists. Hitler himself once said that former communists made the best National Socialists because they already understood the concept of an ideological worldview and they understood such things as party discipline and team effort. Now, I've read in some places that after every beer hall battle, certain communists would find themselves picked up off the floor and brushed off and bandaged by the same stormtroopers who had just kicked their ass. And the brown shirts would buy the guy a big stein of Löwenbräu or whatever and say, "Look here, kamerad, you're running with the wrong crew. You want to fight against capitalism? Don't do it for those Jews who are being run from Moscow. Come and do it with us and Papa Adolf." Now, this was a very complex historical situation, which I'm not going to get into because it's one of those many how many stormtroopers can dance on the head of a pin type arguments that in our wee little movement we use to avoid laying all of our belly aches and crap aside and getting on with it. Now, one thing all you future leaders of the Northwest Republic out there who are listening to this right now will learn in time is that white people will do or say anything, fall back on any excuse to avoid buckling down and getting on with the job, the actual political struggle to change things, because, never mind, I'll be here all night if I let myself get into that, and I've gone over it before. Now, getting back to Strasserism in Germany, unfortunately it ended up in what was known as the Night of the Long Knives on June the 30th, 1934, but it has survived to this day in one form or another. About 30 years ago, a Danish man named Pavel Riis Knudsen wrote a long essay called National Socialism, a Left-Wing Movement, in which he made the case that National Socialists are really just racist Reds. I even think I may have a copy of that lying around on my hard drive somewhere. Unfortunately, Riis Knudsen then proceeded to totally discredit himself by marrying a Muslim woman, a Palestinian. Well, at least it wasn't a Muslim boy. What with all the movement modernization and everything, these days we have to thank heaven for small mercies. Actually, National Bolshevism is older than that, though. One of the earliest proto-national socialists, the writer Jack London, was very much a non-Marxian socialist and an Aryan racialist at the same time, as anyone who's ever read his stuff will be aware. London viewed the capitalism of his time as a kind of financial Judaism, and again, that's another long, involved story I don't have time to get into. I say non-Marxian because one thing that many of us don't get, nor should we, because it's another one of those little obscure pinhead dancing things, is that socialism and Marxism are not necessarily the same thing, and that many of the early socialists and revolutionaries of the 19th century weren't Marxists, and some of them actually predated Marx. Hell, the first people that we today would recognize as more or less commies was a sect of Oliver Cromwell's Puritan army in the 17th century called the Levellers. Their leader was a man named Colonel Thomas Rainsborough, who made himself such a nuisance that Cromwell had to engage in a genuine conspiratorial-type black ops plot to have Rainsborough assassinated and blame it on the royalists. And sorry, that's me wandering off again. And no, we're not planning on setting up any kind of Marxist or communist state in the Northwest. Seriously, does everybody get that? I don't think I really need to digress into all this, but getting me off onto the subject of no, Harold is not a commie would be a good way to distract me and keep me off the topic of you migrating and getting your asses up here where you belong. Now, if anybody has any serious questions about this, I'll be glad to kick it around some more, but frankly, I think it's a pointless distraction. The struggle is no longer about economics in any form. It is about the physical survival of the Caucasian Aryan race. This isn't about money or who's got it or who's spending it on what. It's about genocide. Okay, another email. This one is from Bob Summers in Michigan, whom some of you may remember from some years ago. Dear HAC, I really like your Who Guards the Guardians series, although I understand why you have to step back for a bit what with the political murder of Edgar Steele and all. What do you say to those who claim that you are obsessed with the FBI and judicial system, and that you are constantly provoking them because you are self-destructive, and you're constantly baiting the FBI on your podcast is an attempt at a kind of suicide by cop? Signed, Bob. Well, no, Bob, I'm not suicidal. I may have mentioned this on this show before, but there are three things in life that I have never been even remotely tempted to try. Drugs, suicide, and homosexuality. And if any of you people are ever told that I have ever indulged in any of those three, then it's a lie. Nonetheless, I understand how sometimes I could come across as a little obsessive on the subject of the FBI and cops in general. I believe I've gone over this before in the past, but it's important, so I'll be glad to hit it again. Okay, regarding this obsession that I allegedly have with the FBI, look, I get that all governments have secret police agencies in order to maintain themselves in power. They always have had since the dawn of time. Hell, the Third Reich had the Gestapo. I get the torture and the spying, etc. It's all in a day's work for the secret police, and all governments do it. What pisses me off about the FBI and other alphabet soup agencies is, number one, the hypocrisy. This constant pretense that these people are in some way morally superior to the rest of us, when in fact they are a good deal worse. I have got a lot more time for one of Stalin's NKVD officers who would drag people out of their apartments by their hair and take them to the Lubyanka and beat them with a table leg than I have for one of these clowns in the trench coats who shows up at your door and just wants to ask a few questions. I am, in addition, really pissed off by this TV crap on some of these shows that I watch off Netflix, like Bones and Criminal Minds and 24. And now I'm sorry to say that one of my formerly favorite shows, The Mentalist, has drunk the FBI Kool-Aid as well. Now that's a pity. I like Simon Baker, and he was one of the few remaining genuinely strong white male characters on TV. Now, I deal with the FBI and other secret police in real life. I'm one of the ones whose emails they intercept and whose words they read and listen to, parsing every sentence to try and claim that I'm inciting to something or threatening somebody or sending coded messages to my hidden army of followers like Joe Carroll and telling them to go put on Edgar Allan Poe masks and stab people, whatever the hell. I have to deal with the results of their hideous behavior, like the Bill White case and the murder of Edgar Steele. They make ugliness in the world, and they make me wallow in it, and I resent the hell out of that. They do not deserve a multi-million dollar industry devoted to making them out to be heroes. They are not. But number two, and more importantly, the FBI and cops in general are central to the problem that this country faces. It is they who carry guns and do harm to people for money. It is they who keep Obama and the Democrats in power. It is they who make this tyranny possible. And we keep nattering and chattering about the balloon going up. Well, if these evil mercenary sons of bitches in the silk suits and the black body armor would just stop doing what they do and tell that vicious third world tyrant in the Oval Office to go fuck himself, they won't kill and torture and imprison at his command anymore, then he and his liberal democratic buddies wouldn't last a week. The balloon really would go up. Now, that is how it will happen. Someday, when Obama, or Hillary, or that bugger boy, Barney Frank, or whatever other nigger or man-hating feminist bitch or screaming pervert the Democrats decide to put into the Oval Office can no longer pay them, they will walk off the job and leave their liberal progressive bosses to the vengeance of the people that they have tortured and tyrannized for so long. But we have to wait for that day. We have to wait for some kind of economic collapse that will do as much harm to the dwindling number of normal people as it will to the ultra-wealthy, liberal, progressive, multicultural, sodomitic elite. We shouldn't have to wait for some kind of catastrophic collapse. We shouldn't have to wait for the FBI and the militarized police paychecks to start bouncing. If they were decent men, they would tell Obama and Eric Holder to go take a flying leap right now, and turn in their badges and their guns, or better yet, turn in their badges, but keep their guns, and use them to put right the terrible wrongs that they have done to this country and its people. But they won't do that. They prefer to keep on brutalizing and destroying other people as long as they get that direct deposit into their bank accounts every month. So, yeah, they piss me off. Tell you what, here's a song for all you secret police assholes of various alphabet agencies out there. This is Little Big Town.
What goes around comes around. Feel it breathing down heavy on you. You made that bed you're laying on. Deeds that you have done now you can't undo. You got bones in your claws. They're gonna come out, they're waiting for the sun to go down. You can't hide from your demons, feel them all lurking around. You're running scared cause you know they're out there, they're waiting for the sun to go down.
Okay, a while ago I was speaking, as I have in the past, about how all these FBI shows on TV pissed me off and so forth. Just to make clear yet again, I do not have cable TV and would not waste our money on it. I have a battered monitor and a DVD deck and a Netflix account and a Hulu.com account. Plus, I can occasionally get DVDs really cheap in the bargain bins at Walmart and Big Lots and whatnot. In addition to watching FBI shows to fuel my rage and keep it white hot, I keep up with certain Hollywood television series in a general sort of way. Not exactly binge-watching, but I do read reviews and whatnot in order to keep up with whatever is moving the minds of our lords and masters. A good example of this is a television series called The West Wing, which ran from 2000 to 2008 and amounted to one mighty exercise on the part of Jewish producer Aaron Sorkin and his whole crew to rewrite history as if the Democrats had won the White House in 2000, and all about what a wonderful paradise on earth Al Gore would have created if that mean old Supreme Court hadn't stolen the election, which, yeah, they kind of did. Let me put it this way. They had Martin Sheen playing the Al Gore presidential character, which gives you an idea of how realistic it was. Also, I am told that at some point in that series, which, like I said, ran for 8 years, they even mentioned me in connection with some Southern Poverty Law Center thing or something. Anyway, now they've got a similar series on called Scandal, about a fictional Republican administration instead of this Democrat Obama shower that's actually in power now. Yeah, I know most of you wouldn't watch 5 minutes of this one because the lead character is this smart-ass, high-yelling Negress lawyer. But once you tune out the politically correct horse dung, which is what you always have to do when watching anything at all out of Hollywood, it's actually pretty funny, although not intentionally so. In fact, personally, I think Scandal is a scream. My two favorite scenes so far are when the President of the United States smothers a female Supreme Court justice to death with a pillow in her hospital bed, and when the female Vice President of the United States, who is a real 700 Club fundamentalist neocon type, kind of a Sarah Palin on steroids, finds out that her husband is a secret faggot and stabs him to death in the living room of the Naval Observatory residence with a pair of scissors. Okay, I know most of you don't have my tolerance for politically correct dreck, and you probably think I'm nuts, but I say again, to me, all this stuff is as funny as hell. Okay. So why am I rambling on and on here about TV programs? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because I saw something last week that was, in fact, pretty sinister to the point where I think we need to discuss it and maybe ask for the help of those of you who do indulge so that you can tell me if you're noticing the same thing or if this is just me being utterly, totally paranoid. Now, the series I saw part of, i.e. the first disc, didn't bother with the whole series because it's so stupid. Anyway, it's called Sleepy Hollow. I will not go over the original Washington Irving short story, which is a classic of early American literature. If you don't know the plot, Google it. Not that this TV series has anything at all to do with the original legend of Sleepy Hollow. It doesn't. In this moronic TV show, Ichabod Crane is English, an Oxford University professor who joined the American Revolution in order to kill the Headless Horseman, but who instead was put into a time vortex by his wife, who is a witch, and who wakes up in 2014 in modern-day Sleepy Hollow, which is a suburb of Albany or Buffalo, some big New York City, and where he teams up with a Kerry Washington wannabe light-skinned female Negress cop whose sidekick he becomes, and he is still pursued by the Headless Horseman, who is now carrying a machine gun. I am not making this up. And yes, I think Hollywood is hiring 12-year-old scriptwriters now. But in the few episodes I watched of this silly show, I noticed something that's genuinely creepy and disturbing and which I have not noticed before in these Hollywood propaganda pieces. Now, the show Sleepy Hollow, or the episodes I saw, is roughly 25% white, if that. Not just the lead characters, of which only Crane himself is white and male, and of course remarkably politically correct for a gentleman of the 18th century. The senior police officers, in addition to the Negress, are a male nigger captain, and a Mexican who is the Negress's ex-boyfriend, and a gook who is turned into a zombie by the Headless Horseman, but he's a good zombie at heart, you see. Don't ask. Okay, all that is to be expected these days, but I noticed that with the bit players, the one or two line walk-ons, and also in the background, in the street scenes, the hospital scenes, the bar scenes, every crowd scene where there's a lot of extras milling around or taking up camera space, less than 1 out of 4 is white. The rest are mostly niggers with a seasoning of gooks and hapas who I guess are supposed to be Indians of some kind. Now, these shows have casting directors who are responsible for hiring, and these crowd scenes are like sets. They're backdrops to the main action, and as such, they are carefully planned and laid out as carefully as on any movie or TV set. The extras, the passerbys, when you look at a scene like that in a television show, they're not just there to fill up space. They've been choreographed, they've been directed, and they've been chosen especially for their looks, their race, their ethnicity, whatever the director wants. Now, this has to be deliberate. Now, there can be no question that the director, presumably with the approval of the Jewish producer, has, for the first time in my recent experience, created a major television series, major in the sense that a lot of money's being spent on it, depicting an America where white people are not just all good and liberal and politically correct, but where we are a clear, invisible numeric minority. Now, some of these street scenes in Sleepy Hollow, so-called, look like the streets of Johannesburg in the old days when I was there. Now, this has to be a deliberate attempt on the part of the people making this series to get white people used to being surrounded by black and brown faces. Black and brown faces that in real life will be deadly dangerous to white people and who will regard us as prey, especially women and elderly people. It's happening, people. Now, you know what you have to do. I've told you often enough. Now do it before you find yourself on some street or in some store surrounded by black and brown faces that hate you and see you as a victim and figure that the time has come to take whatever you may still have, including your life. Do it, people. Come home. Do it now. But that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Still is beating heart in manhood's morning noon.